Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
This morning we have a guest. He's been a regular, is a colleague of ours, but I've called him in to talk about the elections. What else? For a variety of reasons. One is he's very knowledgeable. Two, he was a city councillor, so he has on-the-ground experience. And three, he comes from a political dynasty that has had over, apparently, 1,000 years of political experience one way or the other. So I introduce you to the esteemed Nicholas Lorimer. Nick, welcome to Chai FM.
Very good to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Right. Nick, I want to start. Another reason I've asked you to come on is because you were actually a party agent at one of the voting stations this election, and I just want to get a sense of your experience of being on the ground in a position most of us will probably thankfully never fulfill, and that is that of party agent in at a voting station.
So I've been an election observer, I think 5 times or more, and I've observed in a variety of areas, in Soweto, in the leafy suburbs of northern Joburg, in southern Joburg, around Rivoli. So I have a reasonable idea of how South African elections go. And I will say that I also know a lot of people who have been involved in this stuff. And I will say that, in my opinion, the 2024 election was one of the worst run we've had in our country's history. Now, you know, I was 1 year old when 1994 happened. So, I don't know how really how that compares. But this one was, shall we say, not smooth sailing at all. There were enormous numbers of problems on election day. It seemed like the electronic voters' roll tablets that the IEC had rolled out, which was supposed to be able to work even without internet connection, didn't work at almost every station I've heard of, which meant that a lot of IEC officials had to then resort to using the big old voters' roll, which in some stations wasn't in alphabetical order. And in other stations, the staff were not very well trained, they were not very confident, and so they kept making mistakes or taking a long time to do stuff. And I think that's a large part to blame for why so many stations had such huge queues, is quite simply the IEC was actually in a lot of ways not up to the task this time, unfortunately. I think this trend has been visible at least from 2021, where I think a similar thing happened. That's a little bit worrying for me. Watching the counting of the votes, It was clear that I think only one or two of the people in attendance, there were, I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 people involved at the counting of the votes at the station I was at. It was clear that only maybe one or two of them had done this before. And so there were lots of mistakes and delays. At one point, everyone in one of the rooms counting one of the ballot boxes fell asleep, which isn't ideal, as you can imagine. In another room, party agents from a party started themselves counting the ballots, which is not allowed. It's only the IEC who's allowed to actually count the ballots. So that had to have a stop put to it. And that wasn't actually because of malice. That was entirely due to just people not knowing the rules. And unfortunately, I think that that's the story that was repeated across the country at almost every single voting station. So I'm not surprised that there have been some last-minute changes to results and things. I've also heard that there were mistakes made when inputting the final results into the sort of big results computer. That being said, I think with some exceptions in maybe in some parts of the Eastern Cape and in some parts of KZN, once again, the election was mostly free and fair, and the results do at least mostly reflect, I think, exactly what people voted for, but relatively close, even if stations messed up here or there.
I think two questions. I think the long queues gave the impression of a high voter turnout, which was not actually correct. What is the final tally for the voter turnout?
So that was something that I noticed very early on in the day. I saw the IEC talking about how they expect turnout to be up from 2019. In 2019, the voter turnout was about 66% of registered voters. But I thought immediately, and a lot of other people I talked to thought the same thing, that this was a mirage due to the fact that the voting stations were so slow in so many places. Mm. So the final turnout number was, I think, 58.6, which is significantly down from 2019. And this is, I think, entirely because, well, partly there's a lot of cynicism in the electorate generally, and a lot of people have kind of given up hope that things would change. But more specifically, I think there was a lot of frustration at how long it was taking to vote. I know people who waited in queues for sort of 6 hours in some places. In other places, people waited for three. Some people had a good experience getting in only about sort of 5 or 10 minutes. But I can't believe that that didn't at least drive down the voting numbers a little bit, maybe a couple percentage points. It's also, I think, worth pointing out that the IEC, by thinking that voter turnout was up so early in the day, I think shows that their central command was a little bit out of touch with how the situation was on the ground. And they didn't quite realize, you know, if the electronic voters' rolls had been working properly, they probably would have been able to see much sooner that turnout was down.
No, I mean, we had some feedback from subscribers to the Daily Friend Daily Email, asking, you know, what their experience was. And quite a, you know, a few people commented on the competency, the lack of probably of enough officials from the IEC, and the fact that the incomprehensible fact for me that the rolls were not in alphabetical order. I mean, that's got to slow things down considerably. Is the IEC really at the mercy of the fact that, if I remember correctly, that its budget is not, you know, it's got less money from the government to do the same or a more complex job?
I think that's definitely part of the problem. I think it's a sort of multifaceted problem. I think one of the issues is that they aren't very strict in who they've been recruiting to actually do some of the work. You know, it's not very well paid, if paid at all. I think at the voting station I was at, you know, party agents are not really allowed to speak to the IEC staff. So I couldn't really, you know, interrogate people. But it looked to me like a lot of the IEC staff there were the kind of high school or university students. They were there either because they thought it would look good on a CV or because they had been roped into it by someone else, or, you know, they were in it for a small amount of money. And a lot of them, I think, either didn't care, were not very confident when it actually came to things. And I am generalizing. There are definitely a lot of dedicated IEC staff out there, but just not in the numbers to make the system work properly. And I think part of that is due to the funding being cut, as you say. Part of it is due to the fact that we had this change to the electoral law, which was supposed to take place well before the election, but that government left until quite late in the day. So I think a lot of preparations for the IEC's training and that sort of stuff were probably delayed. And like I said, I think it was also just because, you know, they didn't spend enough time training and selecting the right people for the job. And unfortunately, it definitely had an impact on voting day.
Nick, this has been extraordinary election in all senses, in that there was generally, it sort of came through the polls, you know, over the last 6 months, that the ANC was likely to lose a majority. And then in its usual sort of surge, a couple of 2, 3, 4 weeks before the election, it appeared to go up in popularity, and the possibility was then muted that they would get 50, 51, 52%, and then it tracked down again. But I don't think anyone expected barely getting into the 40s to be the result. What's your view on this really extraordinary outcome?
I think a very big psychological threshold has been crossed. Mm. For 30 years, the ANC has been at the center of politics in South Africa. Arguably before that, since at least maybe 92 or so. The ANC has really been the dominant political force in the country. And I think within the ANC leadership, there was always this feeling that the organization, the party, everything was bigger than any one individual, that this party would just kind of keep ruling. While I'm sure the ANC did see polling that suggested the same thing, and I'm I think some of their actions during the campaign suggest that they were worried that this might happen. I don't think it was fully internalized. And we're now sitting in a world where life, political life outside the ANC is very possible, even if you kind of keep going with the ANC's sort of brand of things, like the MK and EFF parties have certainly shown that that the ANC can break up and still you can still have a seat at the table even if you leave the party. And also that the opposition is not really going anywhere. The DA has maintained its solid block of 20-ish percent of the vote. The IFP actually grew in this election, going up to about sort of over 4% of the vote. So there's a the sort of ANC plus MK plus EFF altogether, I think, only got about 63% of the vote. So not able to sort of change the constitution themselves. There's a lot more political competition on the screen, on the stream, in the electorate. There's a lot more provinces are in play for a change now. So we are really facing a completely different political situation to before. One where, for the first time in 30 years, Parliament, I think, is really going to be at the center of South African politics. We've become used to Parliament as essentially sort of a rubber stamp thing. The ANC will decide at its national headquarters what policy the party is going to go for. And, you know, there might be fighting inside the ANC as to what policies they're going to pursue. But at the end of the day, when it comes down to it in Parliament, they voted on mass and they will have enough numbers to sort of push through anything. Now, every single vote, every single decision in Parliament, every single law, everything is going to have to be a negotiation. The ANC is going to have to bring people on board, whether that's from the EFF, the DA, the MK party, maybe cobbling together some of the smaller parties. They're going to need help in order to make their parliamentary majority. And that is a very big dynamic shift in the way our politics works. And I think whether this is going to go in a positive or negative direction very much remains to be seen. But this has definitely been the most impactful election we've had in 30 years. So it's not
sure. So we're essentially we're essentially looking at a future of coalition politics one way or the other. So the two scenarios essentially are this sort of nightmare scenario of getting all the radicals and the guys who want to nationalize things and really send us on an economic path to disaster, the EFF, MK with the ANC, or the possibility of the ANC and the DA moving towards something more palatable and potentially could make a huge difference to the way the economy of South Africa pans out. What, in your view, are the reasons why perhaps an ANC, MK, and or EFF coalition is actually not likely or less likely?
So one of the problems they would have if they got together was firstly that they're all sort of competing for a similar thing. All three of them are essentially parties that are focused very much on patronage. They're also focused on winning the same kind of voters. They all are quite, you know, far left leaning in their politics and policy prescriptions. I mean, the EFF and MK more so than the ANC, but it's not as though they're in different universes. They're all still very much in conversation with each other. And so they compete for resources very directly. They compete for voters very directly. And while I think far too much has been made of these supposed, you know, sort of bad blood between the ANC and EFF and MK, I think you'll find that politicians in practice are very willing to swallow previous insults if it means that they can get into bed with each other to, you know, achieve their objectives, whatever those may be. But I still do think that when you kind of add it to everything else, it makes it a little bit more difficult. I think particularly with regards between the ANC and MK, you know, there was these leaks to the media that the ANC didn't expect Zuma to start his own party or to stand against the ANC. The ANC spent all this political capital essentially protecting him from prison, granting him remission from his contempt of court thing. And so I think it'll be very difficult, especially for the current leadership of the ANC, to swallow that, what they probably see as a betrayal by Zuma and form an alliance with him. I think they'd have a much easier time with the EFF. The EFF in many ways is still essentially the ANC Youth League. And so it'll, you know, it's easier for them to do business with. It's, you know, it's different style, more boisterous, more radical, but effectively it's still kind of in the same universe as the ANC. That being said, we shouldn't discount the possibility entirely, but I do think that the ANC may realize that if it gets into coalition with these parties, they may destroy it from the inside. They may essentially, it's an organization in crisis now. I think this election has been kind of the final straw that has pushed the ANC into a disastrous position, and it needs to change the way it does things. And if it goes the EFF-MK way, it may very well find that it is essentially overtaken by those two parties who swallow up its politicians and its voters if they're not careful.
I would have just thought one area would be a sort of, you know, be against any radical left coalition, and that's the fact that both the EFF and particularly MK have made it quite clear that, you know, they're not they're the antithesis of constitutionalists. They would destroy pretty much the constitution. Whereas the ANC's, a lot of its, what credibility it had, I don't know so much it has, but it negotiated from a position of relative strength one of the world's most lauded liberal constitutions. So if it were to get into bed with anti-constitutionalists, it would really probably jettison any credibility it has.
Yes. I also think that Malema is, while I do think he is anti-constitutionalist, he's also willing to pretend like he's not. He sort of has flip-flopped wildly on how he feels about the Constitution, sometimes wanting to change it, sometimes not wanting to change it, sometimes saying he loves the Constitution, other times saying that it's staying in the way of progress. So he's a bit of a mixture. But MK is very explicitly run against the Constitution. They very explicitly said they want a parliamentary majority system where the parliament with 50% can do whatever the hell it wants. They very much have basically argued for the abolition of what we might even call democracy. I know that Jacob Zuma has talked about ending the secret ballot, for example. I think the ANC is kind of being torn by its contradictions. On one hand, it sort of wants to, you know, transform the economy and radicalize and nationalize things that feels very comfortable to it. But at the same time, it also produced this constitution, which it's been very proud of, and it's usually given a lot of respectability to the party. And now it would be being asked to be kind of choose between the constitution it produced and the ideological sort of priors that the ANC is so obsessed with when it comes to, like, you know, economic centralization and planning and nationalization, all that sort of thing. And I suspect the ANC will probably, at least at the moment, veer towards staying out of bed with especially MK, precisely for that reason, which is that it's just a bridge too far for the ANC. The ANC has had a program of taking the country in the National Democratic Revolution direction, which means the ANC gaining more control over society, which means dismantling what they see as the inequities and problems with the capitalist economy of South Africa. But it's always done so slowly, sort of piece by piece. It's never gone full bore on that. And I think that has been one of the reasons why the ANC has managed to kind of, you know, not drive the country off a cliff like Zimbabwe or Venezuela has been. And they're very much sitting at a crossroads as to what direction they're going to take now.
Then now to look at the other side, and that is a possible coalition with the DA, which would give the ANC the numbers it would require. But in this case, I think it would almost be the opposite, where the reputational risk and the risk of potential destruction of the party, if it were to go into a coalition, would be the DA's problem.
Yeah, I think it would be a problem for the DA, but it would also be a problem for the ANC. There's definitely people in the ANC would be very unhappy with forming a coalition with the DA. The DA is going to have a very difficult problem because on one hand, it's promised everyone in the country that it is going to rescue South Africa from what it called the doomsday coalition, that being the ANC forming a coalition with either the EFF or MK. But at the same time, they don't necessarily want to be in a coalition government where they essentially go along with the policies they so oppose. And this is the issue, is that the ANC and the DA have completely different prescriptions for fixing South Africa's problems. For example, the DA opposes black economic empowerment. They prefer empowerment on the basis of socioeconomic position. Mm. This is completely against what the ANC has pursued for decades. The ANC is still committed to CADA deployment. The DA is opposed to that. The DA is opposed to sort of further tax increases and stricter labor regulations, but the ANC is in favor of both of those to some degree. So making any sort of agreement there work would be extremely difficult, which is why I think it would probably serve the DA much better rather than formally joining government and actually, you know, running a ministry or something like that. The DA should rather have what's called a supply and competence agreement. That is, the DA will make sure that the ANC gets the presidency and survives motions of no confidence and is able to pass a budget. But apart from that, they are not in bed together. They will still be critical of each other. They will still pursue different policies and try to get those through parliament. They will sort of vote on a case-by-case basis. Mm. And that, I think, for the DA definitely has some of the some less downsides. It would also probably be easier for the ANC to swallow, because then they wouldn't have to necessarily give up some of their most beloved policies like BE or like CADA deployment. You can't, but, you know, because I just think that at the end of the day, there has to be a government policy. And if you have two parties that have completely the opposite formulations for what policy should be, they can't really sit nicely together in government.
Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish.
But something we discussed earlier today is what this should portend for parliamentary politics is that it becomes central to our government. We're no longer looking at the ANC automatically being able to pass legislation because it has the majority, but it would actually have to fight for every single thing it needs passed. It would have to find supporters from elsewhere to do so. And I know that you've said that, you know, to give Parliament a boost as far as its role in our politics is a crucial change. Could you elaborate on that?
Right. So essentially it will open up the door to the kind of horse trading type of politics that often I think many non-political people find kind of gross, but I think is actually very important for the sort of health of your democracy. Basically, what will happen is government will be forced to compromise on the types of things it does. It will be forced to take on board more suggestions, more inputs. Instead of having, as I said before, an ANC just determining policy in the Thule House and then pushing it through Parliament, now, okay, well, are we going to get the EFF to support this? Are we going to get the DA to support this? We need to structure each piece of legislation in that direction. And as a result, I think, you know, you have all these committees in Parliament which discuss issues before they actually go to the floor and discuss laws before they go to the floor. And the sort of interpersonal politics that uncertain results produces is that there'll be a lot more care and attention in every single piece of legislation. There'll be a lot more crossing of T's and dotting of I's. And you'll find that, you know, maybe the DA will say to the ANC, okay, we'll support this law of yours if you get rid of national health insurance or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that actually creates a much more responsive democracy that isn't just sort of, you know, it'll break up the stasis that we've had for at least 10 years in South Africa of just kind of blundering ahead with the same old way of doing things that doesn't really improve the situation. Now, this can also be bad. You can also means that the ANC starts making concessions on laws that makes them worse in order to get MK and the EFF to support them. But at least it creates the opportunity for fresh ideas, perspectives, and takes to come into the system. So it's neither necessarily a good or a bad thing. It's a we'll have to see thing. What it is it's an opportunity for our politics to become much more dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose, you know, we've seen with the EFF that periodically it does not support the ANC when one thought it might, and it takes the line that is largely proposed by the more liberal opposition. But perhaps one of the advantages of this, and I'll use an example of the of a bad opposite, is the National Health Insurance, which has been in our politics for well over a decade, and we've had public participation processes, and then for those perhaps more naive in the business sector who thought literally days before the president signed the NHI into law, he'd been telling the business sector that all their concerns that they were representing, never mind the broader populace, but the concerns they were putting forward had been taken account of, or many of them, only to discover when the Act was signed into law that what the business sector had to say about did not appear at all. There had been no changes made. Is this likely to make it put the ANC at least under some pressure when it comes to regarding representations made to it by the broader public?
I think that's exactly the case, that it will definitely have an effect, because now each vote may very much hinge sort of almost on a knife's edge point where, you know, even it's difficult to say what exactly coalitions of parties will go which way in parliament, but you may find such more and more situations where the ANC needs just a couple more votes, seats, to vote for some piece of legislation. And if, you know, every single public presentation has been extremely damning of the piece of legislation, it'll just make it that much harder to put forward. I mean, the government already sometimes backtracks on legislation, even when it had a majority in parliament, simply due to public pressure through you know, parliamentary submissions or opposition criticism or that kind of thing. So I definitely think that it has the potential to create a more reflexive responsive politics in that sense. As long as the political actors use the opportunity, if the opposition isn't attentive and active in parliament, if they don't play sort of strategic games, if civil society just sort of, you know, sits back and lets parliament do whatever it wants, then we won't get the benefits of this new balance of power. So it's actually up to, you know, sort of everyone listening, whether they are involved in civil society, whether they're an ordinary citizen, whether they are a political party, to make the best of this new situation. This is what parliament is for. It's time we start using it for what it was intended to be used for.
It's quite an interesting thought, because I would say that South Africa has, by many metrics, a robust civil society. And certainly in the role of official opposition, the DA has brought more to our attention and considered a lot of matters. It's not the only party, but by virtue of its size, it suggests that generally the ability to participate as a society is really one of the potentially best things that can come out of it. We're less reliant on politicians simply doing what is expedient to them.
Definitely.
Thank you very, very much for joining us. Just to look at a small number of the implications of this election, and of having Jacob Zuma's party, if not Jacob Zuma himself, storming the halls of the National Assembly. So things should get really interesting in more ways than one. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me.